Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's interesting to reflect how over the years practice and experience builds up. Thinking, seeing Mariah and Liam here today, just thinking back to 2001. I saw them, they were here with their whole family, staying at the monastery even before I was in Anagarika. I had just gotten here, staying as a layperson, and just thinking back to just the way my mind was then, and the not really being sure what I was getting myself into, and the whole world of the Thai forest tradition. And then as the Anagarika year went by, learning more about Buddhism and being more inspired, reading the life story of the Buddha. Before I came here, I had never read the life story of the Buddha. I was only inspired by Tibetan Buddhism and the teachings of Ajahn Chah, but I never read the life story of the Buddha. And then coming here, reading the life story of the Buddha as an Anagarika and as a novice, being more inspired, deciding to take bhikkhu ordination, and living here as a bhikkhu, as a junior monk, and starting to gain knowledge as to what it means to be a monk and how you live as a monk. And then spending my third vasa, in Thai we say pansa, third pansa in Thailand, and meeting Lungpor Liam. Actually, I had met Lungpor Liam before then. He had a short visit to Abayagiri, and then getting to live with Lungpor Liam in Thailand and spending time at Wat Nanachat and starting to learn the Thai language. Coming back to the West, having a bit more of a perspective about what we're actually doing, what it actually means to be a monk, or what it actually means to be a Dhamma practitioner. So there's this sense of making a long-term commitment. And so as the months and the years go by, there's successes and failures, and we learn from all of that to start to gain maturity as practitioners. And so it's interesting to reflect how at one point there was a lack of knowledge, and then knowledge builds up, and we gain knowledge, we gain wisdom over time. It's almost kind of mysterious how that happens. Think of it as like learning a language. So when you're learning a new language, at first you know nothing about that language, and you start to study it a little bit. Maybe you learn the alphabet and you start to learn some sentences and you can speak it a little bit, but you still can't really hold a conversation with it. Then you go and start to speak with native speakers of that language and you learn a little bit more. And you learn the feeling and the energy of when you say different things in that language, what is the feeling of it? What is the energy of it? And then eventually something clicks and you start to be able to speak that language. And it's kind of mysterious, that point where the learning actually happens. So it's like the same with Dhamma practice. You come into the monastery not really knowing, what's happening. There's a bunch of guys wearing brown bed sheets, sort of with shaved heads, shaved eyebrows. That's kind of weird. Like, what are these guys doing? So we see the external at first, and then we stay here for a little while and see that there's this whole world that the bhikkhus, samaneras, anagarikas here are entering into. So a whole training in sila, in precepts, the whole learning little by little, listening to talk after talk after talk, studying the teachings, studying the suttas, meditating again and again. We've got the work periods here, so engaging in the work period again and again, and little by little cultivating spiritual qualities that are necessary for awakening. This is known as barami. So cultivating various types of barami, spiritual qualities in the lifestyle, and then it builds up little by little over time, and knowledge starts to happen. So just like learning a language, like we study it first, but it seems like maybe we're never going to get it, but we keep at it. There's a lot to be said for persistence. So we're persistent. We keep at it. We keep coming at it from different angles. It seems like it's going to be impossible. We're never going to be able to speak that language. But then we come into contact with native speakers. So we come into contact with our teachers, Lungpur Pasano, Lungpur Liam, the Krupa Ajahns of our tradition. We come into contact with native speakers of the Dhamma, native speakers of the language of the heart, and then through them we start to get a sense of what is the energy of certain sentences, what is the energy of the seven factors of awakening, what is the feeling of the Four Noble Truths, how do we start to get a sense of it? So by living and conversing with native speakers, what is the Noble Eightfold Path like? What does it mean? And so then eventually we start to gain some sort of understanding. Not fluent yet, but at least we can start to hold a conversation. We can start to hold a Dhamma conversation. We can start to develop what we call Dhamma Vichaya, which is reflecting, always reflecting on the Dhamma in any situation. So because this particular story hasn't been told yet, I think I might tell this story in a public talk about the arrival of our new Buddha image. And I think it'd be good to tell this story, not only for everybody here who wasn't here that particular day that this truck was getting stuck in ditches and we were all worried that our stone Buddha Rupa might show up in pieces, but also for recording, since this is being recorded, so it's a nice story. And everybody's probably noticed by now we have a beautiful little enclosure for our new sandstone Buddha Rupa, the Prat Buddha Abhayagiri Sri Sakyamuni Buddha Rupa. And this Buddha has been a couple of years in the making. So our friend, good friend and teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Achalo, abbot of Anandagiri Monastery in Phetchabun, he headed this up, as this was supposed to be a copy of one that he got in his monastery, but we ended up going with a different artist. And ours is slightly bigger, I believe, slightly bigger, slightly heavier than the one that was made for his monastery. And so he oversaw the making of this Buddha image, and so it's finally here. It's finally come to pass that it's arrived at Abhayagiri undamaged, and it'll eventually be front and center in the new meditation hall, in the new reception hall. So the story of the arrival of this Buddha image is a nice one because it started to involve a lot of the locals in the area here. And normally they don't get so involved in the monastery, but this facilitated some sort of involvement on their part. And that this truck arrived in the early afternoon. It's a semi-truck pulling a 20-foot container, which had our new sandstone Buddha Rupa. It also had a Buddha Rupa for Portland Friends of the Dhamma, which just today went via a U-Haul truck, Debbie and Beth driving that down to Portland. or up to Portland, I should say. And so it contained those Buddha Rubas. It contained a lifelike Ajahn Chah statue, which is still in its crate. We haven't unpacked that to see what it actually looks like yet. It contained a smaller wooden Buddha image, and then about 300-plus miniature versions of the sandstone Buddha Rupa, and books, 1,000 Ajahn Chah collections for Pariyatti Publishing, and various other books. So full 20-foot-long shipping container of all of this, all of these things. And our driver, I think he was Thai, actually. Very confident, felt he could make the truck up to where, to our workshop. It's kind of a tight turn, a couple difficult turns to make it to our workshop, but he felt he could make it. But when the truck started to do this first turn off Tumkai Road, then the truck just started hopping up and down, and he couldn't make it. And we're all watching this shipping container sort of hopping up and down. So then he started trying to back up, and then he's going into the ditch, backing up. It's very difficult to back up a big truck like that. And so pretty soon after this started happening, a local guy, still don't know who he is, stopped in his truck and just started giving his time, just telling him, okay, come a few feet. Okay, turn your wheel this way, turn your wheel that way, and go forward a bit, back up, no, back up. And he was urging the driver to perhaps back up a certain amount, and then he could get some momentum, get some speed, and make it around this turn. And so finally, after about, it was maybe half an hour, 45 minutes or so, he got backed up, and he gets a running start. Still, he tries to go around this turn, and the trailer just starts hopping up and down, and he can't make it still. So then he has to decide that, okay, well, we're going to take it in the exit, and we'll offload everything at the house here instead of at our workshop. But this local guy was helping out the whole time. So we think, well, maybe the truck will be able to do a U-turn and turn around at the Christian monastery just another mile up the road, and he'll be able to turn around and get into our exit. So the idea is he's going to go up the road, go in this driveway of the monastery next door, and somehow get turned around there. And so he's able to get up the road, starts going further up Tumkai Road, misses the turn to the Christian monastery, keeps going further, and then we get a call on walkie-talkie that he's stuck in a ditch. And so we take our truck, we go, the whole community sort of going up to see what we can do to help. And sure enough, yeah, the truck is somewhat sideways, stuck in a ditch on the right side of the road. And traffic is blocked both ways on Tumkai Road. So traffic is blocked. And at this point, we found out that the driver of the truck had only been driving for 2 months and actually hadn't ever driven on country roads. So another local truck driver, different from the first guy, comes out, and then people are stopped on Tumkai Road, and we're kind of fretting a bit, wanting to get traffic going. But then people just at a nearby turnout, people ended up just stopping and kind of hanging out. And somehow soon after that, our big truck backed up and got out of this ditch, and people could go on their way. But then everybody just kept hanging out. They wanted to see what was going to happen. So they stayed there, and it was just a lot of locals hanging out and seeing if they could help, or just making little jokes and just hanging out watching. And there's actually this big turnout on Tumkai Road with an oak tree, which it's about a mile and a half north, a mile and a half up from here. It has these big letters burned into it, THC. And when Tanti Tapo and I, in 2013, we were doing a training walk up Tamkai Road to test our gear and do a training walk for going Tudong, we came across this THC tree and sent a picture of it to my friend Mark Sperry. And he said, "Oh, I know what that means. That must mean Theravadan Hikers Club." And so we call that the Theravadan Hikers Club tree. And back to the present, this other local truck driver who was obviously very skilled in driving trucks on our local roads, eventually got the truck driver of our truck to get out, and he got in and was able to maneuver the truck himself, get it turned around at this turnout with the THC tree, and got it turned around, gave some good instruction to our new driver, and eventually able to. And he had given up maybe an hour of his time. It's just quite lovely that he gave up some of his time. Then able to get in the exit, the monastery exit, and then offload the truck. Samanura Kondanyo driving the Great All, this like super forklift that we have for building of the reception hall. So we used the Great All to get the Buddha image out. We offloaded all the books, and everything went fairly smoothly then, but ended up taking all afternoon because of this whole kerfuffle of, well, actually, it ended up taking all afternoon because we tried to take a shortcut. We wanted the truck to get to the workshop and offload the books where their final resting spot was going to be. And so that would have saved a lot of time, and that ended up taking a lot more time trying to get the truck in there. So a good lesson about shortcuts there that we seem to have to learn over and over again. But quite satisfying once that there's sandstone Buddha was in a big crate, and so we took it out with the forklift, put the crate into its little temporary housing in front of Debbie's office, and undid the crate, got to lay eyes on the new Buddha Rupa for the first time. This is quite satisfying. So nice to get the locals involved inadvertently. And so it's good to reflect, how do we hold our minds in a situation like that? And I felt that situation energetically was a lot like Tudong, a lot like these wanderings that we do. We're wandering out, going either walking up to Pacific Hermitage or just doing a walkabout in Northern California. You run into a lot of situations where you have to come up with some sort of way out or some sort of solution, and yet nothing is apparent. There seems to be no way out, or it seems to be out of your control. And so with this truck, it's like this guy's getting stuck in ditches, and the truck is getting shifted this way and that and hopping up and down, and we've got a sandstone Buddha Rupa in there, which has been 2 years in the making, and we don't really have any choice. Things, you know, we got to have this work somehow, and yet it was largely out of our control. And so we start to, what's going to help in that sort of a situation that's completely out of our control? And this is really where the practice comes into play, where one's practice gets tested. Whatever your mind defaults to in that type of situation, that's where the practice is. That's where it's at. And so is being afraid going to help? Is that going to get the truck out of the ditch? Is that going to get the Buddha Rupa here in one piece? Is worry going to help? Is anger going to help? Frustration? So in those types of situations, I think it's helpful just to be as calm as possible. Just be as calm as possible in that type of situation, right when the situation starts. So this could be anything. It could be a dangerous situation that one is in. So to be as calm as possible. Getting lost in the wilderness, for example. People who stay calm tend to survive, and people who panic tend to do something rash or foolish, and sometimes they don't survive. So as calm as possible. What can we do to stay as calm as possible? And the universe provides. So the universe provided us with people, local people who've never even seen before, never even met before, to deal with this situation, to come and get the truck unstuck, keep things moving in a forward direction. Any of our suggestions on our side didn't do much, weren't very helpful. Any frustration, any worry, any comments that were made on our side weren't very helpful. It was completely dependent on this guy, this skilled truck driver, getting in and maneuvering this truck out of the ditch and getting it turned around. The whole situation depended on that. And so in the practice, there's a certain amount of just trusting. But to develop that type of trust, we have to be able to remain calm in situations like this. Even to the extent where Lungpar Liam said that for an arhat, for a fully enlightened being, they're the one who has to be cool and calm in the middle of a raging inferno. They have to be cool, remain cool and clear in the middle of a fire. And that can be likened to just remaining cool and peaceful in the middle of the crazy, fraught world. This is samsara. Everything's heading for destruction. Everything's heading for ending. So no amount of fear, no amount of worry will keep it from being that way. So we start to look, where's the refuge? Where's the true refuge? We chant it every night, Nati me saranang anyang, Bhutto me saranang varang, Dhammo me saranang varang, Sangho me saranang varang. So that's Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I mean, nothing else is my refuge. I take the Buddha as my refuge. Yeah, and so on. So this is important. Doesn't mean to say we wouldn't be sad if the sandstone Buddha arrived in 1,000 pieces, and we would be, yeah, rightfully so. That would have been a disaster, but things work out in the end. We found that on just Dhamma practitioners, so contemplation of anicchang, that's like the heart of the practice. So uncertainty, everything is just not sure. Lungpar Cha, teaching over and over again, just not sure. So everything is not sure. But when you're in not sure, so when you're really contemplating not sure, and you're realizing things are actually inconstant, actually not sure, and you gain clarity and calm within that realization, then things tend to turn out pretty good. Things are all good. It almost seems like fear is something that brings about situations which aren't good. And then calm and clarity and insight brings about external situations which are good. And maybe that's not always the case. But it seems like being on Tudong, there might be situations where you don't know if you're going to eat or not. But you just have that trust and that ability to say, well, if I get nothing, that's fine. If I get something, that's good. It's like in the suttas, in the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha says, if I get nothing, that's fine. Get something that's good. Being thus with regard to both, one just keeps practicing. And yet, when you have that attitude, then things seem to fall into place in kind of mysterious and strange ways. Things seem to turn out better than you could have ever imagined. And so I like to think about that as like an analogy for you do the practice and live a wholesome life. And if one doesn't attain to path and fruit, then going to a heavenly realm, even that is something better than one could imagine. So according to the Buddha's teachings, it's like we're striving for these very lofty attainments, say like stream entry. But really, even we're just coming back to the present moment. So even thinking, if you're really contemplating uncertainty, things are turning out in your life better than you could have ever imagined. And just apply that to death as well. So you live your life within that uncertainty, within anicchang. Everything in your life is turning out even better than you could have thought, so why would death be any different? So we start to, over time, we gain experience. We gain the blessing of experience, and we start to touch the truths that the Buddha taught in the suttas, that the Kruba Ajahns, the Thai Forest Ajahns taught. This is an aside. I like to think of like the Thai Forest Ajahns, the Kruba Ajahns. I think it's funny sometimes that we study books like Plato or Socrates or like great Greek philosophers, and I like to think like Tenzin Mun was way wiser than Socrates. These are like wise beings of our age, the ones who have the teachings leading to liberation. I like to think like Lumpur Cha was way wiser than Plato. But these are like the great men of our age, the Kruba Ajahns. Let's study them. Let's study their teachings. So, just contemplating what it means to gain experience, because it's good to acknowledge that there is that which is unrealized, there is that which was unattained, there is that which is unreached. And yet it's attainable, it's reachable, it's realizable. So we do what we can to keep learning from our experiences, keep contemplating, keep studying, keep meditating, and keep practicing, and then be able to move into a sense of learning the Dhamma, seeing the Dhamma. And in Thai they say ru hen ben, which is like know, see, and be. That's like Lungpur Cha's famous teaching of like, first you know the Dhamma, then you see the Dhamma, then you have to be the Dhamma. And so always just contemplating, what does that mean? Okay, that's a few random thoughts. I'll leave it there this evening. Sadhu, sadhu.